magical mushrooms. Welcome to the final episode of the illustrious season one of Puzzled Monkey. And what a season it's been. We've collectively covered some truly hot topics, ranging from dirty dams done dirt cheap, Marxist kittens throwing themselves on the means of production, people setting themselves on fire, people growing trees to get guns. It's all been there. All the themes of the modern day have been present. And the true beauty of it all is that I've had such a wonderful, wonderful time providing these bizarre deep dives for you. If I'm honest, I think it may have saved my year. I guess it's given me a real degree of meaning during a time where, if I'm honest, I didn't feel like I had much meaning at all. And in a beautiful turn of events, releasing these episodes has actually led to a kind of reconnection between myself and a lot of old friends from across the world, which is not something I expected at all, but it's been a real blessing. I think that far more than the amount of downloads the podcast has had, and gosh, it's had so many. No, it's had a fair few, and I'm very proud of that. But what I'm more proud of is the breadth of countries and nations and cities that have listened to the podcast. That's a real achievement for me. I don't know why. Maybe it's because it's evidence that I've spread my propaganda, my ideological seed, far and wide, and it's taking root in every continent. Apart from fucking Antarctica, lads, we still haven't cracked Antarctica. Get on to those flightless boys down south immediately. Anyway, even if we don't conquer Antarctica, if we don't place the flag of Puzzled Monkey at the southernmost pole, there have been some other countries tuning in that perhaps I wouldn't have guessed. For example, how could I not mention the famed Moldovan Mafia, who have really been supporting the podcast since day one? I think after a few UK cities, Chisinau, the capital of Moldova, has streamed the podcast more than anyone else. I think they're number three or number four. So thanks a million, my Moldovan comrades and comrades from around the world. It's been a wonderful experience. Anyway, this is slowly morphing into an Oscar acceptance speech. So what in the blue hell am I offering you today? Well, as promised, it's only a Q&A. I think either last week or the week before, I put a call out for people to submit their questions, their theories, their ideas, their fever dreams. And by God, did you guys answer the call? Some of them are absolutely bizarre, fucking insane. But I love that, and I think those are the ones I really want to unpack. So without further ado, let's attempt to answer some of these delightful questions. So some kind soul wrote in and asked for my interpretation of the treatment of the death of the Prince Philip, the husband of the Queen of England. Now, it's always an interesting one when you become a the. You know, I don't know whether if you have a certain degree of power and money that you become a noun, maybe that's the done thing. But certainly this story has caused a stir amongst the British people. You know, you have a lot of people saying that, you know, why should we give a shit? He's an old fella, he's 99. It's barely a tragedy when you're nearly 100 and you die. You know, rarely do we get to that age. Then you have the other side of the ideological spectrum, which say, you know, you need to respect that this is, you know, this is a royal. He's been appointed by God, and they may not make the argument that he's been appointed by God, but there is some degree of, I think, religious adoration towards these figures, these Habsburgs, these Germans that are running the country. And that's no slur to Germans. I'm just stating facts. First and foremost, imagine living for 99 years. I think a lot of us have an aspiration to live that long. I don't know if I do. I haven't settled on it yet. It's not as if you can choose how long you live. But think of the things that he will have seen over that 99-year innings. The wars, the geopolitical shifts, the economic shifts, the ideological shifts, all the shifts. My man is the shift master. He's observed all the shifts. And in a sense, I'm jealous. I mean, I'm not jealous that he's dead. That would be a bit of a perverse jealousy. But I'm kind of jealous about what he has seen in his lifetime. Think about it. The end of the Second World War. The Cold War, the rise of Thatcherism, countless wars as a result of the rise of Thatcherism, modernity, smartphones, although I don't know if he's really gifted on the Tinder and stuff. But I think it's interesting to think about all the things that he will have seen. I do think it is fair to say that it's not easy to adapt to all these shifts that are happening around you. I mean, he's experienced a world remaking itself anew. so many times, and obviously the linguistic territory does shift, rightly so, with those developments. Now, I'm not saying that this argument completely wipes clean some of the remarks that the Prince Philip, the noun Prince Philip, has made in the past. Let's be honest, he said some pretty sexist and racist things, quite overtly sexist and racist things to people across that 99-year innings. But here's the uncomfortable kicker. So have I, and probably, and I'm, you know, I'm assuming here, I might be wrong, probably so have you. You know, I think back to school days and some of the language that was being thrown around towards people. Some of the language that would be, well, not would be, is homophobic, is sexist, and is racist. Undoubtedly, those three. The big triple. And we used to throw these words around like it was nothing. Everything was gay, for example. Every single thing you could do that wasn't cool was gay. Now, we can all say that it had nothing to do with the homosexuality of the behaviour, but we undoubtedly used it as a slur, no doubt. You know, it wasn't a positive thing to call someone gay. You know, that was never a positive thing. There were no positive connotations with that word. And then you have the ableist terms that we were throwing around. Maybe as much as the homophobic ones. Like, Jesus, we used to shout at people calling them retards. You know, if you did anything that was a bit dumb, a bit silly, we would label you as such. And no one batted an eyelid, man. So what I guess I'm arguing here is that, yes, we do need to remember the Prince Philip in his entirety. You know, we can't just get rid of those comments. Those comments are important and we need to remember him as such. But we also need to recognize that we are not holier than thou. You know, we need to recognize that we're not separate species to Prince Philip, the Prince Philip Fergus, I think you'll find. And we've all said things that are questionable, both morally and linguistically. You know, I think the danger is when there is such an obvious target like Prince Philip, a 99-year-old man who has said these things, we jump on it. You know, we jump on it and we want to see him pilloried, which, you know, there is a necessity to call out racism 100%, totally back that. But sometimes I think by doing that so overtly, we curtail the opportunity for self-reflection. And I'm not suggesting we, you know, get out the cat of nine tails and start self-flagellating for that comment we made to our friend in 2007. That's not what I'm arguing for, because I think that is also a pretty negative and, you know, self-destructive way to process our own sin, dare I call it that. But recognition is key. Self-reflection is key. Anyway, let's go beyond the micro and look at the macro. What does the death of the Prince Philip mean for the future of the royal family? But more importantly, I think, for the future of British culture, British identity, and my favourite word, British ideology. I think Philip's death is symbolic of the erosion, the inevitable erosion of the old guard of royals. Now, I'm not a person who knows much about the royals. I've never had an interest in it. You know, I do have problems with unelected individuals owning great portions of land and think that the Queen's consent law, which gives her power to shape, you know, legislation, is morally wrong. So obviously I'm not a royal. I haven't even watched The Crown. I mean, Christ, how can I even comment on any of this if I haven't watched The Crown? Anyway, the death of Philip to me feels like a preparation for the big one, for the Queen's inevitable departure. Because, to be honest, in my little echo chamber, in my delightful social circle, no one appears to have batted a single eyelid over Philip's departure from this world. You know, and I think that's because a lot of my friends would be, you know, anti-monarchy, all of this. But I'll be interested to see how the Queen's death affects them. I think there will be an effect, and I think they will hate that fact that there will be an effect. Think about it. Almost umbilically, we've had a relationship with the Queen since our birth. Her very existence is encoded into the cultural signifiers of this very great nation. Her face is on our tender, in our hymns. Jesus, it's even in the names of our pubs. With her gone, how will we interact with these cultural markers of British existence? I mean, in all honesty, what are the British without their Queen? Who or what will we latch onto as our central marker after her passing? To be honest, I don't think it will be any of the other bumblers within the royal family. I don't think any other member is able to garner the respect, you know, and that's either begrudging respect or real respect that the Queen has garnered. Does this mean that when the Queen dies, so does the idea of the royal? in light of that blockbuster interview between Prince Harold, Meghan, and Oprah, maybe it does. And you know what? Maybe, just maybe, it should be allowed to die. But I think many of us subconsciously are terrified about not being ruled. Without the seeming omnipresence of the Queen and the monarchy, perhaps we'd have to come together and discuss what new cultural idols we would have at the centre of the British pantheon. And I think considering how split, both economically, politically, sociologically, and ideologically, the country is, this fucking puts the willies and the fear of God into so many people. However, it is a fear that we are going to have to confront because time waits for no man or woman, regardless how many jewels they possess. So anyway, that's going to be interesting to see how we reform or deform ourselves in response to the Queen's death. Anyway, back to Prince Philip. The Prince Philip. Because I have a little hot take about his death. Listen, isn't it obvious to you, as it is to me, that his death is a false flag operation? I think, and leaning closely here just so you can catch all of this take, I think David Cameron killed the Prince Philip. Yeah, let it stew for a sec. Let it wash over you. Become one with the take. Think about it. Is there a more effective way to distract attention from conservative cronyism than the death of a royal? I think the prince's death is a perfect smokescreen to distract public attention from Messrs. Sunak, Hancock and Dirty Dave being embroiled in a wee lobbying scandal. I mean, conspiracy aside for one singular moment, why are we always so surprised that our political leaders are doing such dodgy deals? The really tragic thing here is that I think this revelation, which really isn't a revelation whatsoever, will not stop us electing another Conservative government after another Conservative government. Our bar is so bloody low in the UK, it's fucking mental. And I mean that very much on both sides of the political spectrum. I don't think anyone is particularly inspired by anyone in the Conservative Party or Labour Party, but that might just be me. Anyway, you heard it here first. Prince Philip murdered by David Cameron. Now that's a serious piece of clickbait. Can you imagine if it was actually on the front page of the Daily Mirror or something? XPM murders the Prince Philip. Did David Cameron use Russian-purchased Novichok to murder the beloved patriarch of the nation? Is the Kremlin sale of 50 gallons of Novichok to the ex-Prime Minister's Wiltshire home the reason why President Biden is placing trade embargoes upon the Russian state? Yeah, I've definitely gone too far there. Right, let's go on to a bit of a calmer question, perhaps, maybe? Yes, let's do it. So, I was asked about what topics I nearly did an episode on, but then kind of bailed at the last minute. And let me tell you, there's been quite a few ideas I had that did not make the cut. I thought they'd be a bit too weird, even for my delightful audience. There was one episode I wanted to do on hierarchies, and of course I wanted to do an impression of Jordan Peterson throughout. And I had this stupid idea to sing an excerpt of Working Class Hero by John Lennon in Peterson's voice. It would sound something like,
if you want to be a lobster, then just follow me. You know, it's a bloody good thing. It's a bloody good thing to be a crustacean, you know?
In all honesty, that just sounds like Ray Romano's normal voice mixed with Kermit the Frog with a head cold. You can see why I didn't do an entire episode based around that impression. But human hierarchies is definitely something I would like to talk about more, maybe next season. Anyway, what else did I nearly do an episode about? Well, actually, the previous episode, Sewer's Pudding, was initially going to be about how the captain of the ship allegedly drew a massive penis in the ship's root movements before lodging itself in the canal. I basically wanted to use this story as a springboard to look at the deep-seated and I think often unconscious obsession that men have with drawing penises on absolutely everything. And the interesting thing about this, at least for me, is that this act of kind of phallic artistry is quite ancient. After all, some Roman lads etched penis graffiti on Hadrian's Wall during the Roman occupation of Britain. Perhaps this was a sign of domination over the natives, or maybe they were just boys being boys. Christ. Anyway, I wanted to do a little kind of Jungian analysis of why this symbol operates as a kind of archetype, and why there are far fewer examples of vulva street art or vaginal graffiti. Think about it for a sec. Think of your local park or the streets around where you live. I'm sure they're littered with Mickeys of different sizes, dimensions, and personalities. But where are the vulvas, lads? Why are they not there? Is it because the penis is easier to draw? Or is something deeper afoot? Are we just like the Romans, in fact, using the symbol to exert dominion over each other? And why is it always men who draw them? Perhaps, just perhaps, the human Mickey evolved its physical form to be a symbol of oppression. Jesus, maybe I should have done an episode on that. Now that I stop and think about it, I think it is interesting, really interesting actually, that it is men who mobilize the Mickey against other men. Like, I remember on the first day of school, pretty much every year, you'd come in with your new kind of fucking awful trousers and you'd have your new awful pencil case, but you thought it was cool and you thought you were a little don. And then as soon as you turn your head in that first science class, your mate would just daub penises all over it in all shapes and sizes. And that was the height of comedy, you know, that was really highbrow humour. Everyone would lose the plot, even the teacher would have a little giggle like, oh, you guys, you crazy boys, how I missed you. It's fascinating that despite how often gay was thrown around as a slur, no one would ever use this term to describe someone who was drawing massive penises all over your workbook and your pencil case. Which is quite curious, really. Perhaps we all subconsciously recognised that it was a way to exert ourselves over our peer group. Perhaps it was a way of rutting. I mean, the girls never drew penises in anything. Their own stuff, other people's stuff. It was a purely male-to-male expression. Interesting. Anyway, there we go. Those are only two topics that didn't quite make it into an episode. Maybe they will in the future. We'll see. Right, the person who submitted that question had the insolence to ask another. And it was basically about whether I would be releasing Puzzled Monkey merchandise. Now, a trope of this podcast has been my love for bamboo toothbrushes, and I can announce that myself and Bambuji have done a crossover. Imagine if that was actually true. Like, would you guys consider buying a Puzzled Monkey toothbrush? I mean, should I just release one as a really clever joke? No, I don't think so. To be honest, guys, I don't think I'll be doing any merch as part of this podcast. Obviously, it's very small at the moment, so it would be a bit of a fucking mental decision to start making t-shirts with the Puzzle Monkey logo on it, even though I do think the Puzzle Monkey logo is boss stuff. I really like the logo. But no, I think I talk so much about bloody consumerism and, I guess, anti-capitalism, or at least the ideology of it, that it would be just a little bit inconsistent if I started trying to pawn things off onto you. So yeah, no merch for now. Unless this podcast then swells in size and popularity to something akin to the bro slogan experience, and then we'll have to rethink. There'll be a spring line of t-shirts, you know, we're going to do dresses in the summer. It's going to be an entire industry, no. I don't think that's going to happen. And even if it does, hopefully I won't change the morals that I have at the present time. Although, as we all know, time can change a man. So let's see. Right, next question. Ooh, here's a tasty one. What impact do you think lockdown has had on the environment? Now, what I think this question is asking is whether nature has recovered as a byproduct of the lockdowns imposed upon us due to the COVID crisis. And I mean, it's very difficult to measure this, and it's not really a yes or no answer. I mean, that's how the media portrays everything, as if it has a yes or a no answer. You're either 100% right or you're 100% wrong. And that's just a load of bollocks, isn't it? I think in the short term, it's safe to say that nature benefited from the lockdowns. You know, there were fewer cars on the road, airfare was at an all-time low. And obviously then you had the issue of oil prices plummeting, but there's always a bounce back, isn't there? There's always a rebound effect. with this low price of oil, countries could then perhaps afford to buy more. And that obviously seems to have locked us into a future that is based purely on a fossil-based economy. And this is obviously really sad. I mean, that's the most understated thing I could say about it. But the reason why I say it's sad is because at the start of the lockdowns, I do believe that many people felt that we were on the cusp of a systemic change of global proportions. I think people thought that this was a kind of turning point in the evolution of human culture. And I obviously don't know how this kind of revolution looked inside people's heads. But I imagine for many it was this idea of finally perhaps humans are going to situate themselves beneath an ecological ceiling or within an ecological ceiling where they wouldn't go beyond the boundaries that they know, we know full well, reinforce negative and destructive consequences for Mother Nature and us, its inhabitants. But this isn't exactly what has happened. We have received what we were told we would receive, a new normal, a re-entrenchment or reinforcement of the old system with a few new bells and whistles. The same ecological, economic and social issues are still happening now as they were before the lockdowns. Topsoil is being eroded and blown away at the same bloody rate. Corporate entities have more power than most nations. And the Conservatives are still bloody cronies. What's new, really? Something else that hasn't changed in our culture is that despite all the rhetoric, all the research that suggested that nature had recovered just infinitesimally during the lockdowns, faced with a cheap flight to Greece, we will always take it, regardless of the emissions, regardless of the impact. And I totally get it. I'm pale as fuck, lads. I understand. I could do with some vitamin D, you know, for my own sake. But what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, faced with systemic change, I don't think any of us actually wanted it. Because what would it actually mean to move into a different system of being? What luxuries would be lost? And what sacrifices on an everyday scale would have to be made? To go back to the question at hand then, even though it appears that there has been some beneficial impact on nature due to the lockdowns caused by COVID-19, I think this is merely a blip, an anomaly, before we double down on normalized practices of ecocide. As always, uplifting stuff from me there when it comes to the environment. So let's move on to another question. Oh, another potentially upsetting one. Have you watched Seaspiracy? Crikey, how long have you got, lads? So for those of you that don't know, Seaspiracy is the latest blockbuster documentary that is terrifying people on Netflix. Truth be told, I hadn't actually watched it when I was asked this question, but so committed am I to you all that I actually sat down with Meg the other night and tuned into this 90 minutes of aquatic self-flagellation. Christ, it's a heavy one. It's a seriously heavy one. It's about the industrial fishing system and how ecologically, economically, and crucially socially destructive it is. Now, whenever you watch one of these docs that is aimed, let's be honest, towards shocking you and changing your behaviour, I think it's crucial to take stock of your own biases beforehand, you know, your own ideologies before watching, because these things obviously shape your interpretations and your optics on reality. That's what they're there for. So with this in mind, as I settled into the sofa with young Meg, I just spent a wee moment or two situating myself and taking stock of my own tasty ideologies towards animal consumption, which is obviously the main focus or ethical issue of the documentary. Now, I'm a person who doesn't eat meat, and I don't eat dairy, and I don't really have any plans to reintegrate either of them at any point in my life. However, I have eaten fish a handful of times in the last 5 years, and nowadays I even eat eggs relatively regularly. Now, of course, these eggs come from free-range forest hens from the bloody Wirral, but I am in no doubt, and I can be in no doubt, that there is some harm caused to sentient beings in the process of me eating their eggs. Now, after I completed this stock-taking exercise, this very self-indulgent stock-taking exercise, Christ, I'm a fucking loony. Anyway, after I did it, I asked myself the fundamental question, do I think this documentary, Seaspiracy, you can kind of get the ideology from the title and the picture that it's associated with, is it for me? Am I the targeted audience? And probably not. Like its predecessors, What the Health and Cowspiracy, these documentaries are not for people who've engaged in the vegan community. They're for people who probably haven't and need to be shocked in their eyes to become vegans. That's quite clear to me, but maybe it wasn't clear to other people. I'd be interested to hear your views. Anyway, let's get into the content of this cheeky boy. Now, the first thing to note about this film is that it's very, very Hollywoodized. I mean, the first 30 minutes play out like a sensationalized action film sequence. I thought something was one way, but in fact, it was another. This is the kind of premise, you know, I thought fishing was not so shitty for fish, but in fact it is. And then you kind of cue the shitty horn music that's copied from the Inception soundtrack. It is a bit contrived. It's kind of obvious that the fellow was vegan before he actually made this documentary and he's just kind of pretending not to be. But you know what? Again, for storyboard purposes, I understand. Although actually in saying that, I do wish that films that discuss veganism, sustainable consumption and such were less Hollywoodized. You know, if they were less polished and glitzy, I think that would be a good thing. But I guess I might be being an old fart here. Maybe this high production value and the panning shots and the music is necessary for modern humans to kind of care about shit. Our serotonin and dopamine channels have been like irreversibly altered and dulled by Instagram and porn, probably, that we can't even take notice of anything, never mind change our behavior towards it. And let's be honest, we seem to love being shocked and horrified in the modern world. These emotional expressions have become kind of erotic art forms within Western modernity. I mean, just look at how much money horror films make every year. I mean, how many Paranormal Activity films have there been? Couple this with the fact that, you know, despite we say, oh my God, what's happening in the world is so bad and so terrible and so disgusting, we'll tune in more than once a day to be drip-fed our doses of death and destruction on the news. And this is for me where it goes even deeper. I think we want to be horrified. We want to be triggered. Perhaps for some of us, it's the only way, tragically, we can feel anything. And to go even deeper and darker, I think we even want to be horrified or triggered by ourselves. I mean, regardless of your opinions on it, we seem to be living in a time of wokedom. And some people seem to be creating an identity built around self-disgust. They self-hate and self-flagellate to a point where even your man from the Da Vinci Code would be like, come on, lads and lasses, maybe you're taking it just a little bit too far. Anyway, what I'm saying is that Seaspiracy fits in well with this ideology of self-horror and disgust. Like, you know from the title it's going to fuck you up a little bit, and that's exactly why you watch it. Now, even if it does prey upon our need to feel shocked, does this mean that the film is shite and we shouldn't watch it? After all, it definitely ran with some stats that are definitely out of date, namely the idea that the seas will be empty by 2048. However, just because it missed the mark on that stat, I don't think we should bin it and go down the chippy. I think what the film does really, really well, for example, is illustrate the symbiosis and the delightful delicacy of the aquatic world. And it doesn't just point the finger at easy targets like Japanese whalers. It suggests that all nations are, to a greater or lesser extent, implicit within the exploitation that industrial fishing creates. This is such an effective message because, well, firstly, it's totally true, but it also appeals to another modern romance, a romance that hides in plain sight within Seaspiracy's name, our love of conspiracy. This idea that it's not just one enemy out there pulling the strings, it's not just the Japanese, no. There is a web, a nexus of enemies, numberless, faceless, nameless, and they are shaping our reality against our will. You know, people love that shit. I love that shit. I think it's great and it's really entertaining. I think for many, the idea of an Illuminati or an NWO operating in the shadow realm helps us to actually create order out of the chaos that is the present. And Seaspiracy is cleverly? Thomas Cleverly? Jesus, what actually happened to Cleverly? That's another conspiracy. Anyway, what I'm saying is that Seaspiracy intelligently, let's use that word instead, hijacks this love of conspiracy to actually spread an important message that we're actually all complicit in the destruction of the ocean ecosystems. Alongside this, I do think the documentary had some serious ovaries to suggest that sustainability is a load of bollocks. You know, one of the arguments is that there's no such thing as a sustainable fishery. And it begs the question, you know, how can we ensure sustainability when it comes to the oceans, a place that at certain depths we know less about than the surface of the moon? Now, I do have a few issues with this, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But I think overall, protecting the oceans can only start with a recognition that the industrial fishing complex that guides the world currently is categorically unsustainable. I think that's fair enough to say. So fair play to Seaspiracy there. I take my hat off to you for saying that. However, whilst I definitely liked the way the documentary called out certain organisations for bandying around this word sustainability to cover their arses and their bank balances, I do wonder whether it could have gone a bit harder on us, the consumers. But I do recognise also that it's only a 90-minute documentary. It can't cover everything. I'm not going to hold that against it. Basically, my argument here is that we can't just blame the organisations for aquatic ecocide. You know, I think deep down, I mean, how many times have I said deep down today? I'm getting very conspiratorial, cheeky boy. Anyway, deep down, I think as a consumer, you want to be deceived by labels such as dolphin safe, line and pole caught, sustainably farmed. You want to be deceived by this marketing because, you know, it makes you feel better about yourself, or at least it doesn't make you feel worse about yourself. How do I know this? Well, it's the same thing with me and my eggs. I definitely want to believe that these chickens are as free range as the marketing suggests they are, but I know deep down that it's not all fucking swings and roundabouts. What happens to the male chicks that are born there? Well, they're probably put in the shredder, like other egg farms. I mean, think about what I'm saying there. I want to be deceived. It's pretty heavy shit, that. But I genuinely think that we know that fishing isn't sustainable. I think that we actually know that those eco labels are absolute shithousery. We're nowhere near as dumb as I think we'd like to think we are. But at the end of the day, it's more agreeable and certainly more tasteful to plead ignorance than it is to recognise cognitive dissonance. However, I think another point is that this documentary will help to tackle cognitive dissonance because it so viscerally illustrates the brutality of industrial fishing. So actually, again, kudos to the film. They've kind of covered my point there slightly. But as I said, I do think perhaps it could have focused more on the consumer, because I feel like in these documentaries sometimes, it makes us feel like we are complete blind consumers. And for many of us, you know, we either allow ourselves to be that way or we decide to be that way. Either way, we need to recognise that these industries do exist because we want them to exist. You know, they are driven by our demand for these products, these cheap fish. All I'm saying here is that, you know, despite being the easy choice, we can't just cede responsibility solely to the organisations or the businesses that are responsible for this ecocide. We are also, as consumers, very much part of it. Speaking of personal responsibility, what the documentary also showed, and this is fucking critical, is that our consumer patterns and our desire for cheap fish can oftentimes facilitate slavery at sea. This is something that I don't think has received enough attention. There are some really good organizations, the Environmental Justice Foundation do a lot on this, but this is something that I think was great about the documentary. I really rated this. The documentary basically showed that alongside the suffering of targeted species and bycatch, it is also people who suffer directly because of industrial fishing. It shows how people in Thailand, I think, are tricked to come aboard fishing vessels and how they're often kept there against their will for multiple years at a time. I mean, some of the stories are absolutely harrowing. The abuse was monumental. You know, it just shows that slavery is not one of those archaic things you hear and read about in the past. There are still tens of millions of slaves knocking around in 2021. And what this documentary shows is that many of them might just be providing the fish at your fish and chip shop. So yeah, I would say this is pretty necessary watching, this part of a documentary at very least. Now, my last point comes down to the central premise of the film, that no seafood is sustainable. Think about it, that's a pretty strong statement to make. And based on the evidence laid out in the film, it definitely appears true. I mean, definitely at the industrial level, I don't think it is sustainable whatsoever. I do think the documentary would have benefited by focusing on indigenous systems of fishing. In fairness to the documentary creators, they did actually have an interview with a whale hunter from the Faroe Islands, and I think actually that was really good. But I wanted to see actual fisheries that were being governed by indigenous people and, I guess, indigenous principles. There are people in the Pacific Northwest of the US and Canada who have been fishing for a seriously long time. I don't think they've wiped out entire fish stocks, certainly nowhere near the degree that industrial fishing methods have. I think it would have been really good and a strong analysis for the film to go and look at those fisheries, just to see how different, or perhaps not different, it is from what they were looking at in the rest of the film. However, I think their ideology and the hatred of the idea of fishing as a whole, after all, this is a vegan film, was too strong for them to actually go and look at other modes of fishing. And you know, fair play, it's their film. But I think that would have been a really strong point, and it would have really rounded it out rather well. Anyway, there's my take on Seaspiracy. I think it's definitely worth a watch. I have quite a bit of issue with it. I think some of it's very good. And I guess that's the way you want it to be. You don't want everything in your cultural milieu to confirm your own biases. Or maybe you do, who knows. Right, last two questions. And Jesus, Lord, Mary and Joseph, they are hefty fellas. The first takes us to the world of physics and cosmology. Why is there something rather than nothing? I said it was a hefty one. I presume this refers to why the fabric of space-time and the universe as a whole exists rather than not exists. So I guess it's a very philosophical question. Well, I think the logical argument is that in those milliseconds after the Big Bang, well, kind of banged, there was just that wee bit more matter than antimatter in existence. I mean, how mad is it that that shit, antimatter, actually exists theoretically? The idea that the atomically inverse can exist, it just reminds us that we know absolutely nothing. We're just some hairless apes that think we know a lot. I mean, we do know a lot, but we don't know everything. Come on now. We don't know everything. Anyway, after the singularity popped open like some cosmic egg, and when energy chilled out and finally formed matter and antimatter, there was just a bit more of the former, apparently. Ergo, there was something rather than nothing. Because obviously, if there were equal amounts of matter and antimatter being the inverse of each other, they would have destroyed each other. And the vast majority of it did. But what was left behind then became the fabric of the universe. Now, don't ask me how we know this. I presume that these conclusions are the product of smashing subatomic particles together in a lab at CERN. But, you know, I don't know how they prove this stuff. I don't think even if they explained it to me, I'd even understand. But there we go, that's my very limited understanding of why there is something rather than nothing. But that's the physics answer, and whilst I respect physics, I mean, I was shocking at it at school, although I did get a B at GCSE in it, so check this boy out. I think the philosophical question is more interesting, because there's no answer, of course. And I always love it when there's no answer to anything. I think a philosopher would look at the answer I just gave and ask a fundamental question. Why was there more matter than antimatter after the singularity? Doesn't that seem an interesting coincidence? I mean, it certainly is interesting. And I mean, this is the reason why a lot of people, I presume, will posit a god or a creator. I mean, perhaps there is a cosmic gamer who has tweaked the conditions of our universe to create something rather than nothing. Perhaps they're running a computer program, an almighty algorithm to see what happens if you tweak a dial here and season something over there. Or maybe it's just joyously, poetically, and almost even erotically a stroke of luck that there was more matter than antimatter. And hey, who's to say this is something? Perhaps we're living in nothingness. Remember, it is us, humans with our limitations, who have ascribed somethingness to the world we see around us and beyond us. There's a very good chance that somethingness is in fact nothingness, and therefore the binarism between the two is just that. It's a false binary. But see, we don't like these answers, especially in the West. We have a very linear interpretation of time. We have a rationalist perspective of cause and effect. You know, the same thing happens when we discuss the Big Bang. Once we have a discussion of the Big Bang, someone says, well, Who banged the bang that made the Big Bang? In order for something to make sense in our worldview, in our gestalt, it must logically have a prior and a post. It must have a precursor and a postcursor. I'm not sure if postcursor is a word, but in this tone of voice, I think it sounds believable. What I'm arguing here is that we must recognize when we ask questions like this, we are hamstrung by our very linear perspective of how the universe operates. I mean, there have been myriad discoveries in the past 50 years alone that illustrate that this perspective on time and space is just illogical. And it's interesting when you look at different cosmologies from outside the Western world, the ancient Vedic texts and the religions that emerged around them, this pervasive idea of linearity is, well, not very pervasive. In its place is this idea of cycles, of interaction and interconnectivity. And I think in reality, this has meant that certain cultures are more capable of understanding what science is proving, that time is a cycle, not a line. Anyway, I could talk about this concept forever, but I'm going to control myself and move on to the final question of the day. And if you thought the previous one was an absolute whitey, then prepare for this one, because someone's only gone and asked me what the meaning of life is. Right. Building on a non-linear understanding and interpretation of the cosmos, I'm going to flip this question on its head. What isn't the meaning of life? See, as a non-theist, I hold that you have the capacity as an individual to set the meaning of life. And this means that we ourselves, my friends, are deities. This means, and this is quite scary in fact, that meaning is not something you can go out and discover in the world. It's not something you'll find under a stone, for example. And there's something wonderfully freeing about this. I mean the idea that the meaning of life is whatever you want it to be. The problem is, we don't live in a society or a world that gives you much freedom and space to discover what that meaning is. And this is why I think, perhaps understandably, people allow the entities and individuals around them, those that hold them in bondage, to dictate to them what their meaning is. We give up the right to others, we give up the responsibility to others, and we give up the power to others in many cases because we can't afford to create our own meaning. In fact, it's now a luxury to have the time to discover what might or might not be your meaning. And at the end of the day, you might discover there isn't one. I don't think there's one meaning for one person. I think you can have multiple meanings. And I think actually, the idea of meaning might itself be a bit of a Trojan horse that stops us actually focusing on being. I mean, so many books have focused on, you know, helping people to find their meaning. And some of these are absolute seminal pieces of work. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, for example, is amazing. But I do wonder, increasingly, whether man's search for meaning sometimes is a futile effort that actually leads to unhappiness. Because I've spent so much time looking for meaning, searching for it. Jesus, I've been looking for it under rocks. I told you not to do it, but I've been doing that. I've been going down the park. Under a rock, damn it, not there. Under a stone, no. Pebble, no. It's just not there to be found. But I've still done it. I'm still feverishly looking for it. But during lockdown, or lockdowns, as I should say, I think like many, I've been forced to reflect on the fact that maybe there is no meaning. And that sounds like a really tragic thing. Maybe there isn't. But what it has made me do, and this is really positive, is that it's made me focus on being, on the present. I spend so much of my mental life in the future and in the past, in the interconnected realms of regret, but also aspiration. And it's fucking knackering. You know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have aspirations, but we also have to recognize that we can turn those dreams into tools for our own self-repression and oppression, you know? Anyway, what am I saying? Gusto, what are you saying? What I'm saying is that we construct our own meaning, but sometimes we need to be a bit careful that we don't put too much credence on having a meaning. We're blessed to be in existence whether you believe in God or you believe in fucking anything. If you believe in nothing, that's equally beautiful. You're still here. It doesn't change the fact. So man's search for being, I think, is also a worthy title of a body of work or a body of life. And here I think of one of my favorite thinkers and speakers, Terence McKenna. Ah, man, what a fella he was. You may be familiar with him. Big in the psychedelic community, but also, you know, a philosopher in his own right. Had lots of very interesting, wacky ideas, a lot of which I think are really important. But he has this phrase, and I'm not convinced it's, you know, a direct treatise on the meaning or non-meaning of life, but I think it's helpful for us to listen to and think about at this point in time, you know, at a point where meaning seems to be something that is ascribed to you by an external edifice of power. And if you'll forgive me, you know how much I love to do impressions, I'm going to do it in his voice, because by God, does the man have a good voice. Basically, he says this. Don't watch TV. Don't read magazines. Don't even listen to NPR. Create your own roadshow. I love this idea of creating one's own roadshow. What it communicates to me is this idea that even if we're not created, it does not mean that we cannot create. And therefore, just because meaning doesn't exist, it doesn't mean that we should not try and create it. So there we go. Meaning of life? Answered it, mate. We'll end the podcast there. Guys, thank you so much for listening to over 45 minutes of this Q&A session. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm sorry if I didn't get your question in. As you can see, it would have taken me about 3 days to cover all of them, but I cherry-picked them well, I think at least. So what now? Well, I'm going to take 2 weeks off. A vacation, if you will. Now, basically what I want to do is I want to work out how I can keep doing this sustainably, because I'll be honest with you, I absolutely love it. I think you may have got that impression from this podcast episode and others. I really do. And it's given me a lot of meaning this year, and I really want that to continue. So what I need to understand is what form the podcast needs to take. I need to think about the length of the episodes, how often the deliveries are going to be, if I want guests on, all of these tasty things. I need to just have a little bit of space to think about it. I also need to write some new episodes, because God, that takes some time to do the research. So yeah, I have a few things to think about, but I am coming back. You can rest assured of that. I love how aggressive that sounded. It was supposed to sound endearing and kind. I need to work on my delivery. Anyway, what can you do in these 2 weeks to help me? Is that what you asked? No? Well, I'm going to answer it anyway. Please keep listening to the podcast episodes that are in season one. Please share them. I really want to keep this going. I want to keep the momentum going even when I'm just doing a bit of research. So yeah, keep sharing them. And please, please write a little comment and review on the iTunes store. I keep asking, but sadly, it seems to be a call that no one will answer. Will you help a puzzled monkey in need? Please do. Think of Meg. Think of Lily. They benefit too. So yeah, all that's left to say is that I absolutely love the bunch of you. You're a stunning bunch of people. You've made me feel so happy recently. I hope that I make you feel something from these episodes, and hopefully it's not dread. So yeah, I shall speak to you in 2 weeks. Keep going, keep living, and I hope you find meaning. Ta-ra. Lots of love. Bye-bye.